Happy Sunday. My name's Kate Nelson. I'm on staff here at Reservoir Church, and it's very lovely to be with all of you today. I had a little bit of a heavy moment myself filling out this card. I was remembering being in elementary school and my dad's mom passing away, who I didn't know very well, and she lived far away, and my parents had three young kids at the time, and my dad went back for her funeral, and the rest of us stayed here at home, and was just thinking about that, remembering that. So I don't know if you guys had stories of pets or people or other things, but thank you for taking a minute to think about this. I'm going to be telling some stories today. I feel like stories like invite nearness, closeness, being together. So if you're towards the back and you have any inkling of a desire to move a little closer as we engage in stories today, feel free. Also, if you're happy where you are, enjoy your spot. We are in the middle of our fall series on what we talk about when we talk about God. We've been looking together at a biography of Jesus in the Gospel of John, one of these people who early on captured stories of Jesus and his life. Today, we're going to think about what we talk about God in the form and the person of Jesus, who poets have called the exact image and representation of God. We're going to look into something of who Jesus is and what he does, and particularly, we're going to look at a story today where Jesus conquers death. Before we begin, I'm going to share a story in just a moment of an experience that I have had with death, but it might become clear through that story that it will have been pretty much my one significant experience of death. I made it about 28 years through my life before I had to say goodbye to someone that I loved. Death isn't something that we talk a lot about. It's not often what's maybe first thing on our minds when we wake up or in our conversations. But the reality is death is part of our world. It's part of each of our stories. And all of us in this room have a perspective on death. All of us have had experiences of death. Some people might have experienced significant loss in this room. Some people might have even had a very traumatic experience of death somewhere in their family or in their community. Some of you might touch death on a daily basis in the kind of work that you do. So again, we all have a perspective. We all have stories. Even if our perspective is, I don't want to think about it, I don't want to talk about death, that's still a perspective on death. So again, we all have a talk inside of us. I have this talk that I'm going to give today. You have a talk that you could come up and give today too. And this talk for me is going to change throughout my life. It's going to change as I get older. It's going to change that, assuming that I outlive people that I love, that I outlive parents or partners, friends, colleagues, maybe even children. This talk is going to evolve throughout my life. So it's always evolving for all of us. But I do want to share my perspective today. And I'm going to start with a story. Last summer, two summers ago now, July of 2016, I got the call that I had been dreading for years. My family calls me Katie, so the phone call was, Katie, Gran's not doing well. You and your siblings should come down to see her in the next few days. Gran, my British grandmother, my mom's mom, some of my favorite people in the whole world, she and my grandfather, who we call Bapa, who's here today, hey Bapa, they live just 90 minutes away from me for my whole life. So I've spent a lot of my time getting in the car and driving down to Rhode Island. So I get the call that Gran's not doing well, and I go to pack my bag, and I remember it's summertime, and they live by the water, so I pack shorts, and I pack t-shirts, I pack my sneakers, I pack flip-flops, and at the end, I look in my closet, and I pick out my prettiest dress, and I put it in my bag, too, because I don't know. I didn't know why, but what else do you pack when you're going to say goodbye to someone that you love? And I got in the car, and I made the ride that I had done so many times through my life, anticipating what it would be like to say goodbye to this woman who I have so dearly loved for so long? And in the end, I got to spend Gran's last 10 days with her. This is one of those 10 days. She's in bed. She never wore shorts. And I took this picture of her in her nightie, and I love it. And being with her as she was going home was incredible. It was astonishing. Gran lived what I knew to be a quiet and deep spirituality. She loved engaging in spiritual things, and she and I loved talking about these things together. We loved talking about the books we were reading. We loved talking about the world that we lived in, and we loved talking about Jesus, someone who we both found so compelling in our lives. And at the same time, I sensed that Gran so often communed with God in her garden. And as with many other things in her life, she kept the deep spaces of her spiritual life in private and interior places, close to her heart, not necessarily things that even we would share out loud. And as Gran was dying, these 10 days that I got to be with her in her home, she very deeply sensed that Jesus was coming towards her. And not just coming towards her, but like coming from the upper left-hand corner of the room. So she'd be lying in bed, and she'd be like, "Jesus, Jesus, I'm coming. Where are you? I think you're coming from up there. Please come quickly. I'm ready to go home." And this would go on for hours a day. Her loving us, talking to us, worshiping Jesus, and then being like, "Jesus, hurry, come, come." A couple of days would pass. She was like very, very, I think, concerned that she hadn't died yet. "Jesus, where are you? I'm still waiting. I've been running, but I can't keep this up. If you don't come soon, I'm going to have to sit on a bench and wait for you." She was really funny. A sense of humor wasn't necessarily like the first thing I thought about my gran when I was growing up, but in her dying days, she became really, really, really funny. So we would hang out with her in her room. We'd sit in bed with her, and we'd also wave up to the upper left-hand corner of the room. "Okay, Jesus, come, come. Granny's really ready to go home." And this is how we would spend our days. All of us in my family could palpably sensed something holy and divine in the room. It was spectacular. It was beautiful. It was heartbreaking. Yes, I had to go say goodbye to this person that I loved, but it was like that quiet, deep place in her heart, that quiet garden she had cultivated with God. It exploded into full bloom before all of our eyes, and it was glorious, and it was beautiful. In the end, Gran died just after sunset one warm July evening. For about the first 3 weeks after she died, I was just so happy for her. I remember walking into her room after she'd passed and just looking at her and being like, "Whoa, girl, you did it. You got yourself home. So what you wanted, I'm so happy for you." And for, again, days and days and days, I was just like, so glad. So glad for her. So glad she got to be with Jesus. So glad that she got to be to this place with this person that she so seemed to long for. And then the weeks passed, and in time, grief came along too, and grief has become a companion these last 18 months. It's a very real part of Gran's death for me. I miss her very terribly, even as I continue to experience her love and her care for me. So today we're going to look at a story together in this biography of Jesus, the Good News or the Gospel of John. And it's a story where Jesus comes and he conquers death. In today's story, Jesus comes to the home of a set of siblings, Martha, Mary, and their brother Lazarus. For a lot of my life, this was the makeup of my siblings. Me and my family, two girls and then a boy. After a long while, we got another brother, so it's a little different, but I have a lot of affection for this family. It reminds me of my own. And in this story, Jesus has gotten to know these siblings, Martha, Mary, and Lazarus, over time, and he loves them very much. And this whole story long, he is compelled by love for this family. Where the story picks up, Jesus and his friends, his disciples, have been in another town, They've gotten word that Lazarus got sick, and then a few days later they get word that he's died. And once they get this news, they decide to go to a town called Bethany where Mary and Martha have laid their brother to the ground. If you want to follow along in the yellow program that you got on your way in, the scripture is printed in there. I'm going to summarize a few parts of the story as we go, so I'll keep you posted on where we're jumping to. We'll start at verse 17. When Jesus arrived at Bethany, he was told that Lazarus had already been in his grave for 4 days. Martha, the sister number one, she hears that Jesus is approaching, and so she runs out to the gate to meet him. And Martha says to Jesus in verse 21, "Lord, if only you had been here, my brother would not have died." They've been around Jesus. They've listened to his stories. They've watched him do what he does best. And they've seen these moments where Jesus has been in front of a sick person and stretched out his hand and he's healed them. So Martha says, "Jesus, if only you had gotten here in time, I know you could have healed my brother." Verse 22, "But even now, I know that God will give you whatever you ask." And Jesus told her, "Your brother will rise again." So quickly, what happens next is that Mary agrees with Jesus, and she beautifully and articulates that, yes, there will be a day when death is no more. And Jesus says, "You're right, Martha, and even more than that, it's me. I'm the resurrection. I'm the life. In me, people will live even after dying." And Martha goes on, "Yes, Lord, I've always believed that you are the one, believe that you're one that, who will redeem our world." And then she runs back inside. She goes to get her sister Mary. And Mary's the one who now runs out to the gate. She goes to see Jesus. And at verse 32, we read that when Mary arrived and saw Jesus, she fell at his feet and said, "Lord, if only you had been here, my brother would not have died." Mary says the same thing to Jesus that her sister did. "Lord, we know that you've healed people. Why didn't you come in time?" But she gets a different response from her sister. When Jesus sees Mary weeping, verse 33, and saw the people wailing with her, a deep anger welled up within him, and he was deeply troubled. "Where have you put him?" he says to the crowd. And they told him, "Lord, come and see." And then Jesus wept, and the people who were standing nearby said, "See how much he loved him. See how much he loved him." Jesus mourns his friend and breaks down, and Jesus wept. Even at the beginning of the story, verse 16, Thomas, the disciple, says of Jesus, "Let's go too and die with him. Let's go too and die with Jesus." Thomas knows that this experience is going to kill his friend Jesus. He knows it's going to break his heart. Jesus mourns Lazarus, and so Jesus weeps. And at the same time that Jesus is present to his own grief, he's also present to the sisters, his dear friends. Jesus responds to Mary and to Martha in two distinct and personal ways, because they both say the same thing, "Lord, if only you had been here, my brother would not have died." Yet they get two different responses in light of the way that each of them relate to Jesus individually. And in light of the way that Jesus relates to each of them individually, in light of the way that they need comfort and connection in this moment. Martha needs to say something, and then she needs to hear something. So Jesus listens to her and then tells her this beautiful promise, a promise about himself, a promise about resurrection, a promise about life. Mary needs to feel something and process something. So Mary crumbles to the floor weeping, and that provokes an emotional reaction in Jesus, one of anger and then one of grief. One of the things that has most intrigued me in the time since my gran has passed away is how grief is collective and individual all at the same time. My family lost our quiet matriarch in Gran. In this way, our family has experienced a collective loss. And yet all of us, there are 15 of us in what I consider my immediate family, my cousins, our parents, my grandfather. All of us loved Gran and knew Gran in individual and personal ways, just as she loved us and knew us in individual and personal ways. So in this way, 15 of us are on 15 different paths, processing our grief in 15 different ways. There's been collective loss, and yet individually, we're mourning and grieving in our own ways. And in the same way, this is true of Martha and Mary and the crowd. There's collective mourning, and yet in the details of the story, Jesus is attentive and attuned to each sister, present to her individually and meeting her where she is. And this is what we talk about when we talk about God, the Jesus who mourns and so he weeps, the Jesus who's attentive to each of us individually, compassionate to meet us in the wake of pain and loss and in the places of our personal grief. In Jesus's reaction to Mary's weeping, we also catch something more than mourning. We catch that Jesus is angry too. We're gonna explore this anger a little bit more, and we'll keep reading in the yellow program. Verse 38. Jesus was still angry when he arrived to the tomb where Lazarus had been laid, a cave with a stone rolled across its entrance. "Roll the stone aside," Jesus told them. There is some back and forth in the next few verses. Martha's worried about the smell, legitimate worry. Jesus says, "Well, yeah, but this has to happen." And then Jesus prays to God, and he said, "God, here, I am here, you are. Let's do this for your glory." And at verse 43, Jesus shouted, "Lazarus, come out." And the dead man came out, his hands and his feet bound in the grave clothes, his face wrapped in headcloth. And Jesus told them, "Unwrap him and let him go." 2 years ago, I was visiting some friends in California, and one afternoon, I was walking around Stanford's campus while my friend was in class. During my walk, I noticed that there was a crowd gathered outside the campus church, and I noticed they were in formal clothing. And the closer that I got, the more that I realized it was a pretty young crowd, a lot of people my age, and that all of their formal clothing was black and it was gray. And in an instant, I knew three things just by looking at this crowd. First, I knew this was a funeral. I knew that a recent student or graduate of the university had died, and I knew that he had died by suicide. I picked all of these things up by just seeing this group. And I continued to walk around campus, and later, after the crowd had gone, wandered into the church, and I was sitting in a pew, and I found a discarded program from the service in the pew in front of me, and I started to read it. And sure enough, I was right. Those three things that I had an instinct about, that's exactly what had happened. This young man's name is Wiley Berghofer. He's a beautiful soul with a beautiful smile, which you can see here on the screens. Wiley's life was rich, and he touched so many people. And I knew this even that day, because I saw that crowd in front of the church, and I saw them smiling, I saw them laughing, looked like they were telling stories. They loved him and they cared for him. They missed him so much. And sitting in there in that pew at Stanford, I was so angry. I was angry that something had gripped onto Wiley's brain and robbed our world and his family and his community of a brother, a son, a friend. I was angry that Wiley was tormented by mental illness, and I was angry that it had gotten so bad. I've dealt with my own experiences of moderate anxiety and depression in my adulthood, and I hate mental illness. I hate what it signals of a spirit of death. I hate the way that it can grip my brain and just make it so hard to get through a day, so hard to look someone in the eye. I hate that pretty much every woman that I know deals with anxiety in some way, shape, or form, and that many of the men in my life do too. I hate that I coach 9-year-old girls lacrosse here in Cambridge, and I can overhear my girls saying to one another, "Oh my gosh, I'm just so anxious today." When I was 9 years old, I did not even know what anxiety was. I hate that my little brother Eddie has seizures every day. And I hate that I know people who have cancer raging through their bodies. I hate that Gran had to die. I hate that I look around this room and I see people who had to say goodbye to someone that they loved. I hate death. I hate that it wasn't supposed to be this way. I hate how violent and violating it is. It makes me so angry. And I think this must have been something of what Jesus felt when he looked death in the eye. When he looked at the thing that had robbed Lazarus and Lazarus's family of his own life. Here was Jesus. He's the one who was sent by the Holy One to come and give life. "I've come so that you could have life and you could have it abundantly." And what does he have to do? He has to look at his friend and see how death has wrapped its grave clothes around him. He was so angry at this violation of life that he had to conquer death. He goes up to the tomb and he says, "Unwrap him. Let him go. This doesn't get to be the end of the story. Release him from the grave clothes. Death, you don't get to win. This is not going to be the end of the story." And death is not the end of the story for Wiley. Wiley is 3 months older than me, and in these last 2 years since I met him at Stanford, that one afternoon, I've loved getting to know him through a web of his poetry and art that I found online, through stories that I've heard his family and friends share about both his life and his death. I have loved imagining Wiley flying free, where sorrow and sad days and bad days are no more, where his tender heart can be just as compassionate and alive as it was always meant to be. And I suspect that death is not the end of the story for Wiley's family either. I suspect that they go on celebrating him and missing him, and that the reason that they're telling his story is so that others too can be free. I didn't know Wiley while he was alive, but even in death, his life offers life to me. And I think that this is something extraordinary, that there's this reality that, yes, life begets life. We all experience it. It's why we create. It's why we procreate. It's how we make things new. And then there's also the reality that life begets death, that all of us who live will die. Everything on this earth that is alive will one day return to the earth. But it strikes me as something extraordinary that in Jesus, in grace, in the midst of the story, that death can beget life as well. Wiley dies. I sit in the pew. I meet him. And even in death, I am brought to life through his life. When Gran died, I got a glimpse of what it looks like for a person to shed her grave clothes. All these things that had clung to her throughout her life, this is Gran. It's a terrible photograph, but I think it's hilarious because this is what she was like while she was dying. Again, she's just like, oh, Jesus, come, I love you. All the joy, all the beauty. Come, I'm running, hurry up. Grant started to shed these things that had clung to her, these grave clothes of shame and secrets, privacy and pride. I mentioned earlier that her interior life of her spiritual being was a very private one, but that was also true of a lot of other things in her life. I think there are many things that happened to her, many things she felt, many things she experienced that she never told a single soul. And in the days that she was dying, it was like anything that was inside of her, anything that had been holding her back, she was just like, ah, so ready to be done with. I'm so ready to be done with anything that's been holding me back. So we heard stories we had never heard before, and she didn't want shame in her room or pride in her room. Anything she didn't want in her room, she said, had to go out the window. So pride went out the window. Secrets went out the window. Anything that smelled bad, out the window. As Jesus was coming closer, the only thing she wanted to do was to be more like him. The scriptures say something along these lines, that when we see Jesus, we'll be made like him. And it was like I got to see the beginning of that process. Gran shedding her grave clothes as fast as she could, not because she felt like she had to, but because she wanted to, and because seeing Jesus made it so easy for her to do. She wanted to be like him, unhindered and boundless and free. In the light of Jesus' face and his drawing near to her, it made it so easy for her to let go of pain and pride. The grave clothes falling off her body, falling off her soul, on a pile in the ground. I pulled out that pretty dress that I had packed that I wasn't sure why I had packed it. Because I was like, oh, this is why I packed it. Like, we want beauty. We want joy. We want to be free. I wore it around the house. It was a little ridiculous, but it was fun. It was like Jesus was saying to Gran as joyfully as he could, unwrap her. Let her go. She's done with these grave clothes of being human. She's becoming exactly as I created her to be. And that's what those 10 days in her room were like. Watching Gran, the person that I love just about more than anyone else in this world. The woman who I thought I couldn't love anymore. The person who I thought was perfect exactly as she was. I watched her become even more of the person she was made to be. And that person was exactly herself, just free. It was extraordinary. So what does angry Jesus do? He comes towards the upper left-hand corner of the room. He shows up at Stanford and he sits with me in a pew while I make a new friend. He arrives to Martha and Mary's house after they've laid their brother in the ground. And when he tells Martha, I am the resurrection and the life, I think this is what he's pointing us towards, that death is not the end of the story. And I don't think the statement is just about the rare event of a person rising from the dead, or even just about the day that may come where death is no more. I think when Jesus talks about being the resurrection and the life, he's also talking about the daily and common experience that we can all hope for. Of Jesus breaking in so we can experience light and life, even in the midst of darkness and death and disease and decay. And I think this just might be what Jesus is up to our whole lives long, making us ever more free. I think it's what it means when the scriptures say that when we see him, we'll be made like him. I think it means that we're going to be ourselves set free. I don't think we're going to be a lot of tiny little mini Jesuses. I think we're going to be exactly who we are, just totally free. All of our grave clothes left at a pile in the ground, and just free and free and free. If you're someone who likes to take notes, there's a section in your yellow program where you can jot a couple things down. I'm going to close us with a few invitations for how we might be present to our own experiences, our own stories of death and of life. The first invitation is to light a candle. Remember someone or something that has died. Many religious traditions remember the dead by lighting a candle. And I've set up two stations with some help of my friends on either side of the sanctuary. And during the musical time of our morning or afternoon now, or any other time between now and then, feel free to stop by the table and to light a candle. Maybe you want to remember a person who you love who has died. Or maybe it's not a person, but a thing. Maybe you lost a relationship or a hope or a dream, and you want to honor and remember that loss. I invite you to take a moment to honor that person and what you shared, honor that thing and what you shared, to honor the grief and the loss, and to remember them. Secondly, talk to someone about your hopes, your fears, your experiences of death and dying in your journal or with someone that you trust. Our Western culture doesn't like to think or talk about death and dying all that often. So it can be a little bit strange to find words for if it's something that we're not accustomed to. We relegate dying as a largely medical activity that so often happens in hospitals. I was 28 years old before I had to look at an actively dying person in the face of my gran. Death just wasn't around my life very much. So I invite you to find someone that you trust and tell them about an experience that you have had around death or dying. Tell them what scares you, what you fear, maybe even what you hope for in your own death. If talking to another person seems hard, I invite you to find a scrap of paper or pull out your journal and maybe write some thoughts there. Maybe create a piece of art, use your hands, do something. For me, there are a number of books that I've read that have been very formative in my own thinking around death and loss. I put a few of them out in the dome. If you're so interested, you're welcome to leaf through them. I ask that you would put them back on the table after you leaf through them so others can look at them, and then they'll be available to check out from our lending library next week. There are stories and memoirs of dying, of losing a loved one. There are stories about what it means when you lose someone you don't have a chance to say goodbye. Feel free to pick up something and skim through it. Next, be present to life. Let go of the fear of death and ask God to help you where that feels hard. For so many years, my biggest fear in my whole life was that my gran was going to die. For years, this is what I feared more than anything else. I was usually the one to call my grandparents first, and anytime I had a missed call from them, my heart would go into straight panic mode. Oh my God. Papa's called to say that something's happened to Gran. And I would call and they'd have like some fun, happy thing to say to me. And I'd be like, oh my gosh, you stressed me out so much. Eventually, I did get the call. It happened. I got the call. Gran's not doing well. Come and say bye. And it was horrible. And yet it welcomed me into this beautiful and amazing experience that I had with Gran, getting to watch her go home. My new biggest fear is that my sister's going to die. My sister's here in the room. She's super healthy. She's beautiful. She's very young. There's literally no reason for me to think that she's going to die. I'm ready to let go of this fear of death. One day, either Lucy or I will die, yes. And whatever days or decades that we have left, I want to be present to the life that we get to share together. I don't want to be worrying about when I'm going to get the phone call. I mean, it's kind of absurd, but I might maybe not be the only person in the room. I don't know. Let's see where we can be present to life, where we can let go of our fear of death. And finally, notice death around you. Ask Jesus to let life in, whether your prayer is one of mourning or anger. You might be experiencing death in a very near at hand way today. Or maybe you're like me and you open the news in the paper or on your laptop, and you're confronted with the reality of death that exists in our world. The reality that we live in a world plagued by death and by dying. What if God could redeem even the most tragic of deaths? What if God is so angry and brokenhearted about mass shootings in Las Vegas, about hurricanes that have torn through our country and southern islands, about war in Syria, about Trayvon Martin, about your grandma or your spouse or your friend? What if God is working as hard as God can to be the resurrection and the life? What if Jesus is about the business of healing our hearts, meeting us in our pain, offering us life, even offering our broken and dying world life? Let's notice our mourning because it points us to what we care about. It points us to what breaks our hearts. And let us notice our anger too, because that points us to something as well, that the world is not right and we have work to do. What would it look like if Jesus showed up in our world and looked death in the face and said, "Unwrap her. Let her go. I'm here so she can be free. I'm here so you can be free. I'm here so we all can be free." The band is going to lead us in a song that has been meaningful to me in the time since my grand died. And from there, we're going to head into worship together. The lyrics of this one to two lines that they're going to sing are fairly simple. The song goes, "You don't have to come, but you always do. You show up in splendor and you change the whole room." And I think this is who Jesus is, and I think this is what Jesus does. Jesus didn't have to come up through the left-hand corner of Grand's room. Jesus didn't have to sit down in the Stanford Chapel with me as I got to know Wiley. Jesus didn't have to show up to Martha and Mary's house after they laid their brother in a tomb. You don't have to come, but you always do. And not just that, you show up in splendor and you change the whole room. So the song's going to go a little differently than our normal worship time. You're invited to sit exactly where you are, in whatever space you are. You're welcome to stand. You're welcome to turn this into your own song. You're welcome to let the words wash over you. They're going to sing this song a few times over, this line a few times over. If you start to wonder if it's ever going to end, it will end, so don't worry. We're going to sit in this moment at least a few times through, and then we'll head into the rest of our worship time.